my name's Kate Bowles and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust as you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's new artwork, One and Other. The date today is the 8th of August 2009 and the time is 7:15 a.m. If I can please ask you to state your full name, your date of birth and where you come from.
Hello, my name is Paul Garcia. I was born on the 21st of April in 1952. And I was originally from London, was born in London, but I've since moved to Suffolk, which is where I came from today.
Lovely, thank you. And how are you today?
I'm feeling quite excited. I think it's not something that I would normally do. This is slightly outside of my comfort zone, I think. So I'm looking forward to it.
Good. And what was it initially that motivated you to take part in One Another?
Pure whimsy. I can't remember quite where I saw the publicity for it, but I looked at it and I read it and I thought, my kids will never expect me to do that. So I clicked the apply button. And that's it. That was my entire motivation, I'm afraid. Nothing wonderful or high-minded.
And what was their reaction when you told them you'd applied?
My middle son was jealous because he's also applied and not got a place yet. My youngest son, probably when he sobers up, will be interested. And that's not to say he's a drunk, but he does go out on the razzle with his friends quite a lot. And my daughter said, "What's that then?" I had to explain it to her, so and I think she just sort of shook her head as if to say, "Oh dear, that's Dad being silly again." So.
And when you found out that you had got a place, how did you decide how to use your hour on the plinth?
Well, that was quite difficult because I thought, well, I can't sing or dance or play the bassoon. I'm not an actor. So I can't do anything dramatic, and I thought, well, you know, what am I doing at the moment? What's my interest at the moment? And for the last two or three years, I've been interested in creative writing. So I thought, well, I'll sit and write. It won't be kind of visually stunning, but it will be interesting for me. It'll be an interesting experience to do it in such a strange place. And so I'm hoping that. The results will be interesting as well, so for me at any rate.
And is there a particular piece that you're working on at the moment with your writing?
For this particular project, I have decided to try and finish off a complete short story about being on the plinth. I've sort of drafted out some of the bare bones of it and done, you know, one or two paragraphs already, and the idea is to try and finish it off. But now, I have got a couple of other sort of writing projects on the go besides that at the moment, but they are really personal just for me. I mean, it's very unlikely that any of it will ever get published.
And is it in the first person? Is it about you? About the person on the
page? No, this particular story, no, it's going to be sort of Edgar Allan Poe-ish, a sort of mystery thriller horror thingy about the last person on the plinth. Hope.
The last person, as in the previous person?
No, the person who is last in the series of 2400, number 2400.
Mm. Interesting. Do you think it will be based on your experience?
Yes, I shall be drawing on this particular experience and build that into the story, yes. Because I thought there was some, when I started to draft it out, I thought there were some bits of this that I can't write until I've actually done it, because I don't know what goes on. So I can sort of describe some of the behind the scenes stuff.
Very good.
And the red t-shirts.
Is it going to be handwritten, or do you have a
laptop? No, I've brought my laptop. Handwriting I find very difficult. I realised with some horror a little while ago when someone asked me about writing that I hadn't actually written anything longer than a post-it note, 1996, by hand. My handwriting is very difficult to decipher even for me. So and the last time I wrote anything of any length, it was a real struggle. So. Typing has always been easier, so
yeah.
It because you can read the finished result.
Mm. And your other projects that you work on with creative writing, would you like to talk about those, your writing work?
Well, I've more or less completed a novel. I did, in 2006, I finished an academic thesis on the life and work of a mathematician called Percy MacMahon. When I'd finished, I decided that I was never ever going to write anything academic again, because the style and the finished product was so horrible that I was just very unhappy with it. I mean, it did the job, you know, I got the PhD out of it, so in that sense it was a success, but I still don't like it. But this chap, Percy MacMahon, was very interesting, not just for his mathematics, and trying to explain why the mathematics was interesting is very difficult, but as a man, as a person, he was also very interesting, and I thought that would be an interesting avenue to pursue. But of course, there's very little left in the archive of personal stuff. He wasn't associated with an academic institution, so there aren't boxes and boxes of his letters and diaries and stuff. All that has been lost. I mean, he left all his academic papers to his nephew. His nephew had no children, and so I imagine all the boxes of papers that he did have were tossed away after the nephew died in the 1940s. So what I wanted to do was try and reconstruct what this man's life might have been about, what he might have done, how he might have got to all the different places he got to, because I there are some fixed points in his life that I know about. You know, I know when he was born, I know when he went to school, I know when he went to the military academy, I know where he was in India, I know when he came back, I know all the sort of the important things, sort of waypoints in his life, but it's the spaces in between that I wanted to try and fill out. And the only way to do that was to make it up, because there is no record. So what I wanted to do was create a plausible account of his life. And I've more or less done it, and I've sort of stopped for the moment. I mean, I may go back to it and tinker with it at a later stage. But the second part of the project is to write a similar sort of story about his daughter, because he had one daughter who was taken to America when she was about 18 months old by his wife, who then subsequently divorced him while she was in America and remarried. And the daughter became a dentist in San Francisco, and she died in 1961. And there's not much you can find out about her life, because she wasn't famous in any way, so there's almost nothing in the record, but there are just a couple of entries in the US census. She was a dentist, certainly. I found her dental career, as it was, when she was at college, studied to be a dentist. And then 20 years later, she was in the census as an actress in a film studio. And then 10 years later, in 1931, she listed herself in the census as being a steamship stewardess. I also know that her mother, the one who left Percy to start with, I don't know when she died. She may have died in the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, but that's not certain. But certainly, because the daughter was living later on after the earthquake with a woman who had the same birth date and was also born in Italy, but with a different name as her mother. So I think her mother may have changed her name after the earthquake for some reason or another to try and escape something, don't know what. So I thought it would be interesting to try and make something up about that. Mm. So that's, but I've only done the first three chapters of that. I haven't quite got to San Francisco yet. We're still in Colorado.
Brilliant. And do you think the novel about the mathematician is going to be published?
I think it's very unlikely, because I have tried to find a literary agent in a sort of desultory, half-hearted kind of way, and I've had 7 or 8 rejections. It's not mainstream fiction. It's not going to be a blockbuster. It's not Dan Brown or anything like that. The subject is interesting to me, but probably not to anybody else. I mean, there may be one or two other mathematicians who studied his work who might find it faintly amusing. But it's not going to make a publisher lots of money. We're not going to sell the film rights to, or anything like that. So, well, that'd be fun to make a film of it. I can see the opening sequence already. So, no, I think it's unlikely that it will be published unless I have a brainstorm and decide to pay for it to be published myself. I mean, you know, for £1,000 I could have a couple of hundred copies printed and send them round to people, but I don't know.
And why this particular magician? What was it? Are you a mathematician yourself?
I used to be a maths teacher. I think it would be a bit heavy to describe myself as a mathematician, but I started to do the thesis in 1999, and my supervisor said, oh, do the history of a branch of mathematics called combinatorics, which is essentially about counting things. And which is a huge field, you know, it was far too big. And I was hunting around, looking at lists of papers that various mathematicians had written on this topic. And I was sat in the reading room of the Radcliffe Science Library in Oxford, going through these huge volumes of lists of papers, and most of the time I couldn't understand even the titles. I had a clue what they were about, really. And then there was this one paper by Percy McMahon, which was entitled On the 30 Cubes You Could Make with 6 Differently Coloured Squares. I thought, well, I understand that, and making coloured cubes sounds quite like fun. So if in amongst all this other mathematical stuff that he was writing about syzygies and determinants and permanents and other things, I've forgotten what they are, he can write about coloured cubes, then he might be an interesting sort of chap. And then, of course, I found out about his career in India, the fact he'd come home sick and couldn't go back to active service, and then his first marriage and how that ended in this sort of acrimonious divorce across the Atlantic, and then how he sort of broke into the world of Victorian mathematics, which was very cliquey. I mean, it was very sort of Oxford and Cambridge and a bit of London University, but you know, that was where all the mathematicians came from, and he'd come from nowhere, and he came in late as well. I mean, he was 26, 27 when he got back from India, so he didn't actually start doing mathematics until quite late in life, and he never had a degree. So, you know, he did. I thought, well, he's done well. You know, he's carved out this huge career for himself. I mean, he was a fellow of the Royal Society, and he was president of the London Mathematical Society. He got 4 honorary degrees, 3 mathematical medals. You know, and then I think in the last year or two of his life, he must have suffered from dementia, because he ended up in Bognor Regis, where he died on Christmas Day in 1929. So that must have been a rubbish Christmas for his wife. And I thought, well, as a man, he's interesting, you know. So that's why I chose him, and also because if you're doing a thesis, it's good to do something that nobody else has done and nobody else had bothered. Somebody had been a mathematician in America who'd done his collected works, who collected all his mathematical papers together and written about them in a very erudite fashion, which was very handy for me because it meant I didn't have to do that. But because no one else had bothered with the rest of his life, you know, the field was open for me. So, you know, if you look him up on the internet, what there is was written by me. So his Wikipedia entry, primarily.
And how about yourself? Where are you from? Would you like to say a little bit about, a lot about you? After a thorough description of the mathematician.
Yeah. Well, I was born in London in 1952. Had a not desperately wealthy, but, you know, okay upbringing. You know, we weren't rich, but we never lacked for anything. I went to a grammar school, and then as the sort of thing that teenagers do, after my O-levels, I made a complete dog's breakfast of the sixth form and A-levels and didn't get any. And then I went and worked in Hamburg as a nursing assistant on a voluntary basis for 2 years, well, nearly 2 years, it was actually about 18 months, I suppose, in the end.
What sparked that move?
I'd been, as a younger teenager, I'd been doing voluntary work with an outfit called International Voluntary Service, which was essentially going around decorating old ladies' kitchens. And then I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to get these A-levels. Perhaps it would be best if I left the country. let's go and do VSO. But VSO at the time, I mean, we're talking, this was, 1969, they were only taking graduates or people with building skills, and I was neither a graduate nor a builder. So, but VSO were very nice when they rejected you. They sent a long list of other organisations that sent people abroad to do voluntary service, and they got down to the B's, and the British Council of Churches accepted me on their programme called Community Education for the Young European, which involved working in a German hospital for a year on a voluntary basis. And I liked it so much, I went back under my own steam for a second year. Mm. It was good fun. And in a sense, I suppose that's sort of coloured the whole of the rest of my life, really. Because I came back, there was some hoo-ha over where I was supposed to be working in the hospital, and in the end I resigned because I didn't want to work on men's surgical. And I came back and I had a daughter and a girl who I'd met while I was in Germany. She'd been on the same programme, but she'd come back earlier. And we ended up getting married and having three children. And then, when did we get divorced? Late 1980s, 87, I think, 86 or 87, we got divorced. And then I subsequently remarried Mary, and we're still married 20 years later. I have been in that time, I've worked as in commerce. I've done sort of shipping, freight forwarding, that sort of thing. I did that for a long time. I've spent a couple of years working for my father's firm before it went bust. I started doing maths with the OU, and when I got my first degree with the Open University, I retrained as a teacher, and then I spent 17 years as a maths teacher before I got tired of the abuse. And in 2001, I escaped the teaching profession and joined Hertfordshire County Council as a statistician, and I'm still there, and it's very peaceful. No one swears at you, no one spits on the stairs, and you don't wake up in a panic at 4 o'clock on a Monday morning and think, oh my God, I've got to teach the builders to do percentages. So it's, you know, wonderful. So that's sort of my life story in a nutshell, yeah. Very small nutshell.
To pick up on a couple of elements there, initially you said you worked for your father's business. What was that?
He was made scientific instruments, a firm called S. Garcia Limited, and they'd started shortly after the Second World War. It was started by my grandfather, who I only ever met once, I think, who saw a hole in the market, because during the war period, none of the scientific instruments, none of the balances, none of the weighing machines in laboratories had been serviced for 6 years because they'd been all too busy fighting and what have you. And so he saw a hole in the market, so he started up this firm to do servicing of balances, and then they go to manufacturing. And my father, who trained as a lens grinder in his youth, someone who makes, you know, lenses for spectacles and microscopes and stuff like that. They start with a little blank bit of glass, sort of round circular bit of glass, and you have to sort of grind it into the right shape. And he trained to do that, but he was also kind of politically motivated, and I think he was a member of the Communist Party at one stage, and he got blacklisted and couldn't get a job, so his father took him on at starvation wages, which didn't do much for the sort of family relationships. And so the business remained small, and then I joined in 19. I'd been working in shipping, in a shipping firm, that's right. And my father then decided that they could do with some help in the office, someone to do sort of drawing and clerical stuff and what have you. And I said, well, I could do that. So I went to work for them, but the firm didn't thrive particularly, partly because the premises that they owned were compulsorily acquired by the London Borough of Haringey, who then failed to pay the appropriate compensation, and that just dragged on and on and on. And then in the meantime, they got a big contract from the government of Pakistan, but it was big for them. It was only 30,000 quid, but they got a confirmed irrevocable letter of credit for this stuff, and neither my father and his brother, who ran the firm, were not particularly good businessmen, really, and they failed to take into account that in order to sell stuff for 30,000, you need to spend 20,000 on the materials. So they were running quite a heavy overdraft and a bit of a loss. And then when they presented, they thought it would be all right because the government of Pakistan will pay us the 30,000. They presented this confirmed irrevocable letter of credit to the government of Pakistan, who said, there's no money, we're not paying. And the stuff was already, you know, on a boat to Lahore or somewhere like that. So that was a bit distressing. And they just wouldn't pay, you know. They didn't care. The government of Pakistan, they do what they like. You know, who's going to stop them? And then Lloyds Bank, who were the bankers at the time, said, well, can't have that. They shut down the overdraft and the firm had to close. So that was the end of that. So it put my poor father in the unenviable position of having to make me redundant, which I think upset him a bit. But then, we got over that. And he started a new career as a hospital porter, because he wanted something where he had no responsibilities for staff or management or accounting or anything. Mm. And he thoroughly enjoyed pushing old people about in wheelchairs. Mm. He did that for some years, and then he decided he was getting a bit too old for that, so he went into management. And he got a job as a second deputy administrator in the Salvation Army Mother's Hospital in Hackney, which was quite fun. And then later on, I think he worked at Barts for a while till he retired. So I went back into shipping for a while. I spent 5 years working for a freight conference, which was very entertaining, because I used to get to go on trips abroad and stuff like that. But then they brought in a new senior person who wasn't from shipping, he was from accountancy, and he took one look at all these staff members enjoying little trips abroad and said, well, we're not doing that anymore, all meetings in future be in London. So it took sort of half the fun out of the job. And at that point I just finished this Open University degree, so I was able to I won a place with the Inner London Education Authority's we'll pay you while we train you scheme. I think I must have been in almost the last year that they did that, and so I retrained as a teacher, which was a very scary business. And then I worked in a secondary school in Hackney for about 3 years, and then decided that that was too hard, and I'd try and go into further education, because I thought, oh, you know, slightly older children will be more motivated, you know, it'll be easier. Haha, shows how wrong you can be. Because an awful lot of the kids who go into further education colleges, are there not because they want to be, but because they have failed at school in some way, and their parents have said, well, you're not hanging around the house all day, you can go off to college. So their motivation levels are not high, particularly. So I stuck that for quite a long time. But then the last job, I was trying to teach percentages to builders and nursery nurses and hairdressers. They didn't want to know, and you could see why. I mean, no hairdresser and no builder actually needs to know very much in the way of that sort of mathematics. And what they do need to know, they can learn on the job, and they learn it much better on the job than they do from some bloke in a suit at the front of the classroom. So, you know, I could see why they were frustrated, but it still was quite stressing to be abused on a more or less daily basis. And I thought, why am I doing this? You know, I could do something else.
And these were adults?
Well, they were 16 plus. The adults were fine. I mean, most of the adults were good. When I had evening classes, adults doing A-level or GCSE maths, they were good fun. I mean, because they were keen. I mean, they were mostly all sort of damaged in some way. I mean, their emotional relationship to mathematics was poor, because they'd had a bad time at school. But they were... Once you got them over that sort of hump, once they got past the fear and they realised they could do it, they were fun to teach. But of course, you can't do that all the time. You know, one of the things about working in college is that you have to teach across the age range, and you have to have daytime classes as well as nighttime classes. And even when I was head of the department at one stage, I couldn't, in all conscience, give myself all the best classes. So, I couldn't do that. So, you know, But so the teenagers were hard work for the most part.
Yeah.
That's what did it. Okay.
And how are you enjoying your position now?
It's peaceful. It's not desperately rewarding from a emotional point of view. You know, I mean, I get paid every day. It doesn't make many intellectual demands on me, so I've got spare time to do other stuff. But you know, it will do for now.
Yeah.
Until I can think of something more exciting or retire, whatever comes first.
And going forward now, what's important to you?
Important things for me, I think, would be for stability in a way, because the world is a desperately unstable place. I mean, you only have to look at the news to see how chaotic it is. And I think I'm very lucky, you know. I mean, I've got a stable home, stable relationships. My children are all doing reasonably well. And I suppose what I want to do is kind of see that carry on. And to see, you know, that my children also end up with a degree of stability and security in their lives, I think.
And are you happy living where you live?
Oh yes, Long Melford is a wonderful place. I mean, we chose that when we decided we were going to move. I mean, I'd been living in the same house for nearly 30 years in Hertfordshire, and it was becoming more and more built up around there. And then we decided, well, we could actually afford to move. Hertfordshire was wildly expensive, and we had to abandon that completely. And so we sort of gradually widened our circle of search. Cambridgeshire was a bit flat and boring. And then we realised that we could actually afford to move to a place like Long Melford, where we'd been to Long Melford sort of weekends away and liked it very much. I mean, it's a lovely village. It's got everything. It's got village stuff, you know, shops and what have you, to make it so that you don't feel too remote. But on the other hand, you're very close to the countryside. And it's not too built up, and it's sort of, and we're lucky now because it's in a conservation area and an area of outstanding natural beauty, so there's not too much development going on, which is nice. It's very pleasant. I love it. You know, every day I sort of wake up and it's like being on holiday, really. And the house we bought is wonderful. I walk around it all the time and think, I can't believe I live here. You know, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So. What's it like?
It's quite unlike what we set out to buy. We thought we were going to buy a large detached house with a garden and a garage, and what we ended up with was a three-story townhouse in the middle of a terrace, which has got a cellar as well. But it is a wonderful location, you know, and it's got a nice garden, which is just big enough for us. But it was just such a beautiful house. It's old. It was built in completed in 1839. So it's actually Georgian in style, because it apparently got half built, and then the developer ran out of money and didn't get finished till 1839. So it was started before Victoria's reign, but not finished until after she came to the throne. And it had been nicely restored by the chap who sold it to us. He'd been there 20 or 25 years, I think, he lived there. And it's a beautiful old building, and it's got everything we want, and it's got, you know, it's rooms with nice high ceilings and nice views at the front. So it is splendid. And of course, it's a wonderful cellar that you can sort of go and hide in the cellar, and you've got room to, you know, we use it as a sort of utility and workshop space, so I can go and do things. I've just taken up in a sort of half-hearted kind of way bookbinding, because I decided, you know, after all this academic stuff and intellectual stuff, I'd like to do something practical. And I finally got on a bookbinding course at Flatford Mill last November, and it was wonderful. Loved every minute of it. So I've gradually sort of been acquiring various bits and pieces so I can do it at home. So I've actually restored a couple of books. I mean, nothing expensive or valuable, just some of my elderly books that were falling to bits, but they're not falling to bits anymore, which is good. And it's quite fun, so, you know, so I can go and hide in the cellar and do that.
That sounds lovely.
It is.
And how about your wife? Would you like to say a little bit about her?
Mary, I met Mary at the school I worked at, she came in as head of department in 1986, which was just as my first marriage was breaking up. And it was just a sort of chemistry thing you get, I don't know, we just kind of got together. And then we married in 1989, and she stopped working as a maths teacher shortly after that and went to work as an advisor for Essex County Council, and then she was there for years and years and years. And then most recently, she was working for the National Strategies as a regional director. And she just recently, last November, stopped that and has been working as a freelance consultant since. And because we thought that she would be able to work less hard if she did that, but actually it hasn't happened yet quite. But we're expecting the workload to tail off sometime later this year, because she works far too hard. She is terribly, she's a perfectionist, that's it, you see. And I keep saying she could settle for just being a mere adequatist. She'd have a less stressful life, but she does everything properly, which is why she's managed to get so much consultancy work without advertising at all, because everyone knows how good she is. And she does everything properly, which is wonderful, really. But it is hard work for her, it's stressful for her, and she's just... She's had sort of arthritis for some time, and it got quite bad in the middle of last year, and she's finally getting some treatment for it, because she didn't want to disturb anyone, you know. She said, well, we pay all this NHS money, you know. You know, that's what they're there for, you know. And so she's finally been along, got some stuff that will hopefully in the next few weeks will make things better, so she's not sort of constant pain with her joints. Would be nice, because she loves gardening, and what she really wants to do is spend all the time in the garden. And that's been becoming difficult for her, not just because of the time constraints, but because of the, you know, sort of the physical constraints. And I think if we can sort that out, then she can carry on doing the gardening, which she's very good at. And our plan, we went to the RHS Tatton Park flower show this year, which is the first time we'd been to a big flower show like that for some years. We had been to Hampton Court before. And our plan for next year is to go to all of them, see if we can do Chelsea, Hampton Court, Gardeners World and Tatton Park, and I think there's another one I've forgotten the name of. See if we can do them all in one year. Might be fun.
Is it an interest of yours as well?
I'm not desperately good at sort of the plant choosing and that sort of thing. I mean, I can dig holes where directed. But I mean, I certainly like being in the garden. I mean, it's pleasant, and I like sort of wandering around it and looking at it and admiring stuff. But Mary likes all the sort of more technical aspect of choosing plants and deciding where to put them and that sort of thing.
And do your children live in Milford as well?
No. They're all scattered all over the place. They live in youngest son lives in Worthing, middle son lives in London. And my daughter lives in a place called Westgate on Sea, which is in the sort of edge of Kent near Margate. Hard to go and see them because it's always a long way to drive. But yes. Right.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that you would like to say about taking part in one another today? I'd like to mention your outfit, actually.
Oh.
very, very smart. Mm. How did you choose this? Is this
the jacket I bought, this sort of pink raspberry coloured jacket with the blue stripe in it. I bought that because it was reduced in the Brook Taverner sale to 50 quid. So I thought, well, can't get really. I just wanted a light summer jacket last year. And this, you know, I thought this would make a change. Yeah. It certainly turned a few heads at the office when I went to work in it a little while ago.
And the A on your...
That's for the Richard Dawkins Trust or Foundation or whatever it is. Richard Dawkins is a famously militant atheist, so I think it's A for atheist. I admire a lot of what he says. And I think most of the time, by a lot of the pundits who complain about him in the press, they completely misunderstood what it is he's trying to say. Which is a shame, really, because I think it's quite sensible. You have to, you can't do it in sound bites. It's a long, complex argument, and you know, for the press, what they want is sound bitey stuff, and it doesn't work like that. Mm. You have to be prepared to sit down and listen carefully, and think about what somebody is saying, and very often, people aren't prepared to do that. Mm. And then they write at great length in newspapers about the first thing that comes into their head on the basis of one or two phrases they may have misunderstood, which is a shame, because then people read that and of course they don't bother to stop and think about it or find out about it. So I think a lot of people have got the wrong impression.
And the hat, the straw hat?
The straw, I bought that years and years ago when I was head of maths and computing at Harlow College. I used to dress up every day because I was supposed to be the head of the maths department, and we had this workshop, and I thought, well, I ought to be a presence. So I used to, most of the time I wore sort of evening dress, you know, sort of tuxedo things. I used to buy them from Oxfam, you could get them for a tenner. And a bow tie and sort of shirts with frills down the front and that sort of thing. And then for summer I would wear a pale blue jacket, and I think this was reduced in a sale in Cambridge. So it's a proper bow, actually. The idea being that if it falls off your head while you're on a punt, it will float in the cam and you can retrieve it easily. You know, it was only a fiver, I think. So I bought that, and I used to wear it occasionally, and I don't get much opportunity to wear it really. So I thought, well, today might be an opportunity.
Is fashion something that you've always taken an interest in?
Well, not really. Well, I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, when I was young, I was, you know, in the 1960s, I used to think it was all terribly important, you know, to wear the right stuff, and then. After that, you know, I mean, when you've got children and stuff, you know, you can't really worry too much about that sort of thing because you've got the money. So it's only in the last sort of few years when the children are no longer my responsibility and I've got enough income to worry about it that I thought, well, it'd be nice to dress up occasionally, you know. So you know, I've been there. Although I still tend to look for bargains, so, you know, I won't pay full price for a suit in Marks and Spencers. I go to their sort of the rail where they sell off the odds and sods and buy them from there, that sort of thing. Or wait for sales. Online sales are really good. You can pay. I got two suits for 90 quid a little while ago, which was very good. Oh, it's 90 quid for the pair. Couldn't even buy the material for that. Mm-hmm. So,
finally, is there anything else you would like to say about taking part in one another today?
I'm quite excited to be part of a project like this, because this is only going to happen the once. It will never happen again. And I feel very lucky that I got chosen. And I say my son was, because he didn't get chosen, but I said, there's some sort of stratified sample being chosen here. And a middle-aged bloke from Suffolk is less likely to occur than a bright young thing from London. So I think, you know, he really he's in the wrong place to have more chance of doing it. So that, you know, I was very surprised to get chosen, but very pleased, and I'm looking forward to spending an hour up there writing a story. I say it's not going to be visually very exciting, but there are plenty of other people who do visually exciting things. I'll leave it to those with talent.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.